You're tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us at 716-245-5FFM.
Back to Repmobile 2011. My name is Kyle David Bates, and we're back here in Fulda, Germany, with a whole bunch of people in the EMS Safety Foundation booth, headed up by Dr. Nadine Levick. And it is Friday, May 13th. And like we've been mentioning, we talked about earlier on our earlier podcast with Dr. Levick about the various people and professionals that we have with us. Well, today I actually have three people. They're non-EMS, but they're highly involved in what we're doing and very important aspects of what we're doing. So before we get into that, we're going to do a quick introduction. Let's start off, Chris. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, hi. My name is Chris Fitzgerald. I'm an ergonomist, human factors consultant from Melbourne, Australia. I've been working as an ergonomist for over 20 years, and I've got a background in prosthetics and orthotics, so sort of biomechanics and human movement is an interest of mine in the context of ergonomics and occupational settings. For the last, since about 1998, 1999, I've been involved in the ambulance industry, predominantly in Victoria, but in some aspects of other states in Australia. And we've, at that time, around about that time, there was a legislative change that provided rules around occupant protection. And so we've been building ambulances under a certain environment or a certain regulatory sort of code, and it's sort of taking us in a direction. I've been lucky to be involved in the foundation for the last 4 or 5 years, and that's why I'm here at Fulda this time, as part of that ongoing involvement.
I was going to say, you're one of the standards here in the foundation.
I have been here 4 times.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like 8, but this time it's 4. But yeah, so I'm quite familiar with Repmobile and what goes on and what to find here and how to sort of seek out some of the interesting and different things available here.
Now, before we continue, I should actually mention to you that we are going to have the Australian contingency on this podcast. It seems like everyone's coming in. Now, Chris, but you actually have a little bit of you've been a little bit of our interpreter here at times with the background, a little bit of background German.
That's right.
German and stuff. So it's come in handy a few times, saved us from walking into the wrong bathroom and
yep,
eating the wrong stuff on that. So my next guest is Andrew. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. My name's Andrew Bronke. My background is physiotherapy, but I've recently finished a PhD in the engineering faculty of RMIT in Melbourne. So I'm from Australia, Melbourne as well. And what we've been doing since leaving the clinical space of physiotherapy is working on a way to measure back movement. And what we want to be able to do, what we set out to do, was to be able to record the movements and muscle activity of people in their daily life, whether that be at home or at work. And so we see that there's significant applications for this technology in the occupational health and safety space, and that's part of the reason why we're here at the EMS Foundation at the Repmobile trade conference. So that's a bit about me.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here. And off to actually his left, of course, this is radio, so no one has any idea what we're doing. That's when you do these live podcasts. Is actually a very familiar sound you're going to hear, because it's Andrew's brother, Dan.
Thank you. My name is Dan Ronke from Melbourne, Australia also. Chief Technical Officer at Proactive Medical, soon to be named Dorsa V. Background in IT and the legal industry, and joined Andrew to create this technology around starting about 10 years ago.
Well, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
So,
and
okay.
Thanks. I've always wanted to be naked while on the radio, too. So.
Yeah. Ooh, could you pick that up? Put the towel back on there. Uh-oh, we got stuff flying all over the place here. It's a crowded booth. Anyway, so let me ask you guys, I'll just put out a general question. Why? Why are you involved in the EMS industry?
Well, I think what EMS stands for, it's three main words are about innovation, collaboration, and knowledge transfer. And I think what we've done has an innovative step, as in that hasn't been done before. You haven't been able to record people's movement unimpeded in the workplace. And so I think it fulfills that innovation part. The collaborative part, I've really enjoyed being here and mixing ideas with some world leaders, for example, like Chris Fitzgerald from an ergonomics perspective. We also had Ronald, who's brought his ambulance down from Oslo and has got some, like it's a world class and some leading features in that ambulance. And Chris was able to take us through a webinar about that this morning and do a tour of the ambulance. It's been great to meet Jim Foster, who's had years experience as a paramedical. And so you're able to share ideas. We've also got Jonas, who's both not only an industrial designer from Sweden, but he's got a mechanical engineering background. And so to mix minds with some people like that about making the emergency services a safer place for the people being transferred, but also for the people who are transferring those people, so the ambulance workers themselves, just I think it's a really good mix of background and qualifications.
Very good. So, Chris, what brought you into, how did you get into this?
Like, yeah, sure. My approach to ergonomics has been trying to measure the problem, and it's a sort of simple approach, but it takes you in different places. So a lot of my experience has been in unusual environments like abattoirs and the television industry, and in a lot of those industries I've been able to do sort of detailed breakdown of what's the work that's performed and then try and understand the physical work demands for those various tasks. When I was first asked to become involved in the ambulance industry in the late 90s as we moved towards a new platform for vehicle, which was the Mercedes Sprinter, and also within the banner of requirement to have forward-facing seat, rear-facing seats only, no side-facing seats, and we've had that situation for the last 12 or 13 years, and also the requirement to restrain objects to certain standards. We defined the basic parameters around which we were designing ambulances. So I was fortunate enough to be asked to be involved in that and was able to use a detailed analytical methodology to review design and come up with design improvements. And the benefit for both myself and also my customers was the longevity of the relationship. So I was able to continue adding my knowledge and supplementing them back to them, as I continue to do now. And also just to be, even though external to those organisations, be available as a specialist resource to be able to contribute. So part of the pathway through our conventional ambulance has really been through the provision of specialist ambulances. And about 5 years ago, we built our first complex patient ambulance for both bariatric and high acuity patient transfer. We cut out lots of cardboard and we stuck it within a larger wheelbase vehicle. And we got very, very close to the design with minimal modifications subsequently to the subsequent vehicles that were built. So it's sort of identified that if you apply involvement of people doing the work, as Andrew indicated, collaboration, if you're prepared to review equipment and say, test it and measure it, so this works, this doesn't, so extract what's available in the marketplace in terms of practicality but also performance, and bring it all together in a design concept and an operational concept.
And I think that's absolutely amazing what we're trying to do, because in EMS, it's been kind of like, well, we do what we do because, well, that's the way we've done it, especially in the States.
Yeah, yeah. Why are fire trucks red? Because they've always been red. Yeah. It's not the best color to see them. So there's a lot of those old sort of values and old behaviors that need to people, you know, there's opportunities around those to improve and innovate. And innovation is not always necessarily recognized as innovation in its early phase. And sometimes people have to be prepared to try something different. And that's, in fact, one of the major benefits of an American contingent coming to Retmobile in Germany. It takes you out of your environment, puts you in another very foreign environment. But the reality is that a lot of the technology, the ambulances that you see here, work on a day-to-day basis, and they're very effective for the crews that operate in them. And the best example I've seen of that, I think, ever, including the Australian vehicles, which we're fairly proud of, was the Norwegian ambulance that Ronald brought down and we all had a look at today. It really is probably one of the most contemporary standard ambulances in the world. It's very unassuming in its design, but it's highly practical and quite sophisticated.
I think that's one of the biggest things, is to try to improve, you know, what we have. We improve the product, and it may be, you know, starting. We had Jonas on here yesterday and talking about just starting from the beginning. You know, take what you have. Like you're talking about, you know, here's my van. Yep. Now let's put what we have into that van.
Yep.
And, you know, because there are a lot of injuries. There's a lot of deaths, especially in the United States. There was one just this past weekend with an ambulance on that. And it's becoming harder and harder to try to justify these people, you know, why we have these big trucks with these, you know, these big bench seats that can carry 14 people in the back of an ambulance, but they want to.
Yeah. So I mean, as Ronald highlighted today in his session, they've stripped down their first response equipment to a very, it's a series of probably about 6 kilo loads. That you got the monitor, you got your small oxygen kit with some gear, and then you essentially got a drug box with some oxygen therapy equipment as well.
Which is 6 kilos.
Correct.
Because we talked about it, he and I were talking about that. So, I mean, because that's the one thing, is that we carry in the States a lot of stuff because you just never know when you're going to need it. And over the last couple of years, I've changed jobs. I've gone from the flight side back down to the ground side. But our vehicles are Suburbans, you know, so they're in a support utility vehicle, which is all our gear is in, and then we'll hop on board the ambulance. So what I'm noticing lately is my shoulders have been really kind of sore in the rotor cuffs. And I'm sitting trying to figure out what it was, and I'm thinking, I'm now carrying about 25-pound monitor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm carrying probably about a 15-pound drug bag, and I'm probably carrying about a 12 to 18-pound house bag. All at once. Did you see me trying to get through the door? And that kind of leads good to what you guys are working on in terms of the back injuries and measuring that. And you guys have been around, all three of you, actually all three of you are kind of collaborating on this.
That's correct, Kyle. And as a nice lead into that is that the ability to now measure particularly back movement and potentially other realms of movement of the body is really now available. Previous ergonomic assessment methodologies have relied on observational methods. There's been various correlational studies that are trying to see how consistently people can perform that, and certainly in complex tasks there's usually not a strong correlation. So having a technology that can enable you to measure what people are doing across a long time period, across multiple tasks, is now possible. And I think you'll find that this technology is going to become known about very quickly, and is going to revolutionize how we evaluate and quantify peak demand activity, and then how that's going to be used to drive the process of improvement and change. And the boys can give you all the detail on that, because that's their development.
I was going to say, I mean, is it just observational study? Are you taking pictures? How are you measuring these movements?
Yep. So especially with complex tasks, sometimes you'll want to get baseline measurements of a complex task, and you want to make sure that you get that in the worker's real setting. So you'll have the device on, the person will forget the device is on, it's just adhered to the lower back, and within 5 or 10 minutes they'll forget it's there, and they'll go about doing their normal daily activity. So if you're assessing an ambulance worker, you may choose to do a baseline assessment of them performing their normal tasks, and that will help get data for the first time ever about how an ambulance worker may sit in the van, how they'll get in and out of the van, how they'll transfer people to a stretcher, how they'll transfer the stretcher into the van. You'll also be able to gather feedback from the workers themselves about what they perceive as the risks. So in that baseline assessment, you have feedback from the workers themselves, but you also have baseline data. And once you've got those two parameters, you're able to identify the higher risk activities and then hone in on those. And you often will do repeat assessments of the high-risk activities in a semi-controlled environment, we call it, such that you're able to control a number of parameters, and then you can vary one of those parameters at a time and see what difference it makes to the way the person moves. and that may be in relation to the lower back, but you can also assess other parts of the body using the technology that we have.
I was going to say, I think the one thing that anyone who's been in EMS for any amount of time has is a bad back. I mean, I grew up in the days where my stretcher was on the ground. We came to the side of it, either side of the stretcher. We did a deadlift off the ground,
yep,
and slid it using, you know, basically a twisting motion into the ambulance, and that's what I started up with.
Yep. And if I could make a comment there, Kyle, that you also find that over the last 20 years, I think this is a global trend, that the gender makeup of personnel within EMS has changed. So, you know, fire and EMS are no longer just the domain of the male worker, and which is fantastic, because we've done a study in Melbourne where we've done risk perception, and the people that perceive risk best are, in fact, females. And so their capacity to anticipate risk, to then make decisions about how to mitigate or avoid risk, in general, we consider to be quite strong. The least cognizant people of risk were your bigger, taller, stronger males. And so the whole makeup of the industry has changed, and therefore the physical demands need to be reduced, because your exposures are effectively are much higher than they previously were. And we know that.
So it sounds almost, you know, and we'll come back to the mechanics of it, but it almost sounds like there's two things, and one of them is a psychological, you know, issue. Almost you need to have like a psychological profile, because I would, you know, hypothetically say it's the machoism. It's the, I'm going to lift this, I'm going to get it, I'm a big, strong guy.
Yeah, I think you get in any workplace that you've really got to be considerate that it's a social environment, and there's a whole lot of psychosocial factors, we call them, and really that would be part of that. It's there was a early on in the trade display here, there was a dumbbell marker, so like at a sideshow where you hit the target with the sledgehammer, and it hits the bell if you're strong enough. And you know, the amount of people wanting to do that, the amount of women wanting to do that to show off their strength, and the amount of people that would have two or three goes if they didn't hit the bell with their first go was quite high. So, you know, in a sense that sort of behaviour and perspective, if you extrapolate that into an industry which regularly has to exert high forces in awkward postures, it's a mix that you don't have full control of, and we're seeking to apply smart technology, good methodology, to help develop products that can influence people's behaviour in that environment and get better outcomes.
It's easier to change the system than it is to change people.
Yeah, it's almost
like the quality assessment, quality improvement.
Yeah, I think
philosophy.
Nearly like a safety culture. And sometimes that macho attitude can be a conflict with safety culture. And to be able to break down the barriers and change culture is a slow thing. But one of the things that seems to be helping is having good objective data and a very logical approach to be able to show people that, not only say that's a high-risk activity, be careful, but to be able to show, well, this is how you were doing it, and this is what we're proposing. And if you can present that in video format matched to data, it's quite a powerful message, both to management and to the workers themselves.
I think that's
one of the powerful things we can give the workers to help slowly change that macho image and to develop a safety culture.
Yeah. So you mentioned technology and getting data, and that the people go about their business normally. So what is the technology? I mean, is it radio? Is it computer? What are we looking at?
We're basically looking at a very small and ultra-low power wireless network, in effect. Physically in the system, in the generic setup, there are five pieces. There are four sensors. Two of those sensors are monitoring using accelerometers and gyroscopes. Our next model, which comes out later this year, will also have magnetometers, so the digital compass. And the other type of sensor is measuring electrical activities in the muscles, so surface EMG.
Now, is this commercially available, or did you make these?
No, we created this technology.
Oh, wow.
So this is our, as I said earlier, our 11th year. Our early days were run on a shoestring budget. We went through various methodologies of trying to measure what the, you know, curvature of the lumbar spine was the first element we were after, particularly in the forwards bending, inflection. we had many failures before we had success, and we finally developed a prototype that's proving very, very, very beneficial. It's small enough to be unobtrusive for people to wear it in any environment. And what we're capturing is forward flexion, movement of the pelvis in lateral flexion, so sideways bending. Our next model will include much greater accuracy in rotation as well. And then we measure it on the EMG side. We measure the muscle activity that's supporting the passive structures in the body.
Now, how many test subjects have you gone up to so far?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and I'll split it up into kind of three different topics, because there's application in the occupational health and safety space, and we've probably had in the occupational health and safety area, there would have been 70 or 80 people who've worn the device now, and so we have data sets on a number of different industries. The second kind of market area is the clinical space, where we have a clinical trial running in Melbourne, Australia, and we're about to run a trial in Denmark next week with the Backcare Centre of Fernan. And in the clinical trial space, there's been more than 400 sessions completed.
Excellent.
And then the third realm is the sporting realm. So for those listening, the Australian rules football, or the aerial ping pong, as some people call it. But in Melbourne, Australia, there's a team called Richmond Football Club, and we've had the whole player list do what we call a baseline assessment, and it identifies the people who have poor stability or poor core stability, and identifies them as a risk or a higher risk candidate for injuries such as osteitis pubis, back injuries and hamstring injuries. So what the club's looking at doing is being able to put the people at high risk on preventative programs to reduce the chance of injury for those people. So they're kind of, in the sporting realm, there's been, say, 50 people wear it. In the OH&S space, about 70. And in the clinical space, yeah, about 400. So there's been plenty of people who've had access to the technology. And so far we've had, no ill effects at all. It's quite a simple system. And the sessions may be as short as half an hour for an occupational health and safety assessment, or a sporting assessment can be even 10 minutes, whereas some of the baseline assessments in either the clinical space or OH&S space may go for up to 24 hours if you want to be able to monitor people in their real day, and there's a lot of variation in their activity during the day.
So now you guys have actually been going around. Chris, you've been wearing the device.
I have been, and I still am.
Oh, you are?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, it's unobtrusive. It's essentially white, like wearing some very thick Band-Aids, basically.
Okay. Yep. Now, what has been some, either through this week, but also maybe through some of your studies in terms of EMS, what have been some of the most stressful activities to the back?
Yeah, well, I think the one that, as you mentioned before, Kyle, lifting a patient on a stretcher, there's still certainly some manual loading that needs to be done, and the heavier the person, the harder it is, and the lower the person, the harder it is. Mm-hmm. And so being able to look at some of the muscle activity and the amount of flexion or bending of the lower back when poor Chris was the ambulance driver for the day and lifting heavy people like myself. And you can see...
What are you talking about?
You can see not only from the data, but from the sweat on Chris's forehead, that it was quite a strenuous activity. And so to watch some of the innovations that are coming in relation to stretchers, and some of the more... whether they be hydraulic lifting or some assistive operated power devices, it's been really good to look that there's been some innovation heading the right way to reduce the load on the ambulance workers themselves.
I think we're going to have people out there definitely listening to this, and the question that's going to come, or even probably more appropriately, the statement that's going to be said is like, so? I mean, how is this going to affect me? Great, you got, yes, lifting's bad. I could tell you that. I've been out here for 20 years. Yes, lifting's bad, but it's part of our job. A term we have down in Baltimore, Maryland, is he DFO'd or he done fell out, on the ground, and I got to put him on the stretcher. He weighs 330 pounds. It's my partner and I. Mm-hmm. I maybe I'll get another unit coming, but probably not. I got to get him on the stretcher. So what are we doing? How are we improving, or what is maybe some of the thoughts of how we can improve that?
Yeah, I've got some thoughts there. Is that there's a lot of commonly performed tasks within the industry, and in some previous studies that I've been involved with, we've done a high level of definition of those tasks. We've then conducted biomechanical analyses, and we've also asked paramedics what tasks they find most demanding. So we've been able to, and what we find from our studies is a very high correlation of what we would expect to be very demanding physically and hazardous to what paramedics experience or regard to be demanding and physical, physical or risk to them. And typical tasks are moving the patient vertically from ground to stretcher, moving him across, having to carry and lift at any time, and in terms of various methods. So what we've done is created a whole repertoire of simple equipment, so we're very reluctant to add significant weight or load or volume to the an existing burgeoning amount of equipment that paramedics have to cover, and then try and think of smart ways of getting people to slide and drag rather than lift, and that's quite challenging through vertical space. It's certainly hard where you've got a minimum resource, and the reality is these techniques do require, you know, they're based on having, you know, two people available in most cases. And it's, it becomes a numbers game, so that if we can have either equipment, people have confidence and skill and competence in methodologies to where they can slide and drag rather than sort of their first thought is to lift and carry, then over time we're hoping that those precedents become more normal and in a sense they have a long-term durable effect. But it's not a perfect world. It's an uncontrolled work environment. For a start, there's very few work environments that are uncontrolled. There's not many work environments where routinely people are asked to carry 30, 40, 50 pounds over in all light conditions, in all weather conditions. So it's a very unusual industry. So it'll be very difficult to target or expect every task to be resolved in a short time. But can we target 40, 50, 60% and try and have some impact on those? And if we can, I think it's well worth it. And the boys might have a view on that as well from their sort of broad research perspective.
Yeah. I think, Kyle, one of the things I'd like to make a comment about is, for example, something like lifting the patient from the ground onto a stretcher is a complex task, as you and Chris have said, and it's certainly not easily overcome. But if there are proposed solutions to that, what we do is come in with an organisation and work with the ambulance workers themselves to discuss and understand the issues, and then look at the proposed solutions, and they might be slide boards, they might be sheets, they might be the evacuation mats, they might be some type of
extension straps.
Yeah. So you say, okay, well there's, you know, four or five options compared to what's being done at the moment, and the question really is which one is going to be best for the workers' safety and the patient's safety, and which one's going to be accepted by the ambulance workers. And so our job is to get that baseline data of the way the task has been done in the past and then go through strategically and with a good project design as to how you would incorporate an extension strap or a slide sheet or a slide board. And you look at the difference in data, and it may take a full day or even a couple of days sometimes to do those comparative assessments. But at the end of it, the workers often have really good feedback to us about what their impression is. You've been able to educate them about some of the new proposed ways of doing things, and you also have the data and video to be able to reflect back on. So you do a retrospective analysis and you do a report back to management about what interventions did make a difference, how much difference they did make, and what type of feedback the workers gave us about those proposed interventions. So you end up with these complex tasks being broken up into more tangible and repeatable tasks, and you're able to assess the change that you may make to those tasks. So we don't necessarily design the new tasks. Our job is to assess, to give objective assessments about which one is going to be better.
And then what's going to happen, though, and I guarantee that's all fine and dandy. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, I know this is bad. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's better techniques out there, but my boss isn't going to buy it because it costs money. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that throughout my career. I mean, mind you, I've had companies that they're on top of it.
Yep.
You know, they're on technology. You know, the new stair chairs that use a similar glide as like an appliance, moving and stuff like that, which I've used. It's not good lifting technique, but I want to see how it was. I actually took a guy downstairs with one hand by myself with a stair chair. That's how, nice that was. Mm. So, but So how do we address that? How do we come into that?
So I think one of the other things we've been able to do in the last year is understand what management want. So what management want to make decisions based on facts, and there needs to be not only impressions, there needs to be facts and objective data behind the change that they make. So in a number of projects that we've had where we know that the decision has to be made by either the HR manager or CFO, someone high up in the company, we've been able to make a presentation of the data in a very visual format and assist the safety managers and HR managers present that up higher. And so once we get in front of the CFO, it becomes quite an obvious presentation that the changes we're suggesting, and we'd only do it in this way, are necessary. They're not, and they're based on facts and they're based on objective data, but also some qualitative feedback from the workers themselves. So we're not, the HR manager's not going to the CFO saying, I think this would be a good thing. It's saying, it's obvious that this change needs to be made.
Now, do you go along the lines of addressing, worker injury and lost time?
Yep.
The cost of that versus what it by the technology?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really good point, is that, there are a lot of businesses who do sort of, or don't dedicate enough of their budget to equipment for workers and whatnot. And really, in essence, that exposes them to a much greater risk and potentially a much greater expense in terms of lower back injury. I'm not sure about in the US, but in Victoria alone, the average payments by the workers' compensation scheme for a lower back injury is over $30,000. So every injury is costing somebody, and any company that can reduce its workers' exposure to risk should be doing so. And what this technology does is to facilitate, a more, as Andrew outlined, a more evidence-based decision-making process.
As opposed to just anecdotal.
Correct. And it's highly objective. It, what you can measure, you can manage, that old adage. The other thing about change, though, Kyle, is that you're not going to change everywhere at the same time. So I'm a great believer in someone else's precedent, it becomes my precedent. So, and I think you'll find in a competitive environment, that paramedics move around between workplaces, or they might have, they might interact at sort of various sort of events, that they start to see, someone else will report this as favourable. So I think you'll find that uptake initially certain types of change may not be strong, but if the science behind the relevance of the change and the potential impact of the change is strong, and as Andrew mentioned, if you get a certain number of organisations buying in and supporting that, then soon enough you will generate, whether it's an avalanche or whether it's a trickle, I couldn't tell you, but in some technologies it will be a bit of an avalanche. I think the use of the stair chair type device has demonstrated that. Anecdotally, then anyone will tell you that's probably one of their biggest, single most... changes to physical work demands and manual handling risks at the moment. So it's a matter of then trying to make sure that the information, whether it's product or method, is absorbable, it's understandable, it's simple. It's that keep it simple principle. And that's a design challenge as you move forward, but is also well supported by this technology, because you're still able to objectively evaluate all options of task performance, and it's just magic.
But how can you objectively measure this? Because if I know I have something on my back, I know that you're measuring something, I may perform differently. I may try to protect myself. How do you overcome that?
Great question. And so there's an observed effect, and we see that from the data we've recorded so far, we know that someone will modify the way they move, especially in a clinical environment or in any observed environment for that first 10 or 15 minutes. But once they've had the device on for that period of time, they forget the device is on, and you then get them to be into their more relaxed real-world working environment, and so they move the way they do move once they've had the device on 15 or 20 minutes. So it's important that we make sure that the assessment session is done in their real work setting, and that the videos we do take are kept out of the way, if you like, and you let a person use their own equipment and go about their activity the way they normally do it.
I just think of an experience then, Kyle. It might be slightly off track, but I just sort of visualised that I was teaching some paramedics some alternative handling methods of patients, and we used one of those plastic type spine boards, and we packaged a patient up, and just to demonstrate the effectiveness of being able to drag people rather than lift and carry, we put two long straps at the head end. We were pulling them head first, and one at the tail end to steer. So we actually had three people. We only needed two, but we just did that for demonstration. So we went out over the balcony, over the rockery, down over the road, up the driveway. So we went over about five or six sort of very different surfaces, just to demonstrate what we could do. Everyone found it quite simple. It was quick and effective. Now, you're not going to transfer patients like that all the time, but it was trying to highlight to that group as part of a learning exercise that they can think quite laterally and it's okay. I was encouraging that group, go out and damage your spine boards. Fantastic. Use them. You know, I don't care if you scratch the bottom anymore. Oh, I don't care about that. Use extension straps. So our repertoire of equipment is really quite simple. It's extension straps. It's small PAT slides. It's evacuation sheets. It's slide sheets. These are small, cheap, cleanable or replaceable technologies. They don't add much impost to the load that the paramedic's already carrying. And you can pretty much take them with you every time. So that's sort of the realm that sort of we're coming from. And again, as we move forward, as we continue to work together collaboratively, I think you'll find that there's more and more information coming out to support objectively what's going on here. And through involvement like this side of through the foundation, through this type of podcast, it's a great opportunity to tell everyone about it.
I think, Kyle, the other point I'd like to make is about workers adopting change and management being able to get a decision through management to make that change happen. There's a brief case study example that I'll give you where a major supermarket chain in Australia had been moving milk a particular way for a number of years, and they were looking to potentially implement a change to that process by using a trolley system rather than move the milk manually. Now, from the worker's perspective and the manager of the store's perspective, they could see issues with a trolley system slowing them down. And it wasn't until we'd done the assessment that it became obvious both to the workers and management and to the OH&S manager that it was going to be more time effective, so more productive, to use the trolley system. So it was a win in two ways. One, it was a safety element of reducing the load of lifting and reducing the bending of the lumbar spine. But two, and more importantly for management in a way, or not more importantly, but to more easily understood by management, was the improved time efficiency, so increased productivity. And so often when you are looking to negotiate change with management, you look at it from a safety perspective, but also you have to make sure that will add up for them as an organisation to implement that change. So it's another aspect of what we assess.
Yeah, definitely. I think change is always hard, especially in our industry. You know, 100 years of tradition unimpeded by progress is a common phrase. Fire, especially, you know, in the fire department, on those, because I don't know. I think we're in our comfort zone. You know, it's the way we've done it. It's the way we've always going to do it. But we've got to stop it. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, at the top of the podcast is that, you know, we're injuring ourselves, you know, and we just don't think about it. And, you know, so on that, let's kind of have a little fun here. When you study different groups of people, mm-hmm. How did the paramedics rank in lifting? I mean, they do it every day. Were they good or were they actually so complacent they're bad? Who was the better lifters?
In some ways, in this, whilst we've been at this trade show, we haven't really put the device on the paramedics to do lifting. So the most of the lifting's been done by Chris Fitzgerald, and he's an ergonomist, and so his lifting technique's been okay. It's been quite good. It's just some of the loads he's had to lift have been a bit excessive. And so we haven't really assessed the paramedics themselves in an individual case-by-case basis and then compared them to other industries. So it hasn't really been a focus of what we've been doing.
We did a brief study several months ago on carrying first responder equipment. So we got some initial data just to indicate to the industry this is what you can do. And that was quite clearly indicated, really quite clearly highlighted the the significance of, you know, as we can expect, reduce load, reduce load size, distributing the load, and if possible, using a bag with wheels. But we were able to give data to put that back on the agenda. There's a history to this type of assessment. Every 3 or 4 years it becomes an issue, so we get involved and assess. And really, but this time round, the data itself is being able to drive the process that you really need to go down this pathway. You can't keep coming back here and revisiting it. We've got sufficient data that justifies the level of change. Away you go and implement and follow through. And again, I think it highlights to my early point about driving a process of change, that if we can provide data, if we can make that meaningful to paramedics, that it's real, it's applied, they don't think it's just an academic approach. The work that I've been doing with the EMS Safety Foundation, I've been calling myself an operational ergonomist, and the work that I've done with the Proactive Medical boys is really very much, we're interested in what people do at work and how they do it and how we can make it better. And we've been doing, you know, digging tasks and cleaning tasks and very, very common tasks. And just by a very brief intervention, we've been able to modify tools or methods. And I think we've been able to demonstrate the power of this technology in achieving change, in evaluating change, and then using that to drive the process.
The other thing I think that's relevant on that same type of theme, Chris, is that you're able to provide feedback to the designers of equipment. So if someone is building a new piece of equipment, say it's a stretcher, and they're about to release a stretcher or they've got a prototype made, we can go in and assess that and provide feedback on whether that is how effective that is for the worker who's using that. And pre-release is ideal because there's still a chance to be able to modify what parts are good or what parts may be improved on with some guidance. And so in that pre-release time in equipment, and it's not only in stretchers, it's a lot of other equipment, it's an ideal time to do those assessments and get that feedback about how it works in the real world before it's released, and give the companies the opportunity to make minor modifications to improve the design.
So I guess the next question is, now what? Where are you going from here?
Some sleep would be good.
Some sleep. Yes, it was long nights here in cold Germany.
From here, look, you know, what we intend to do, or what we hope our technology does, is just continue to build more and more data sets. And as you said, you know, to be able to comparatively assess different industries on an aggregate basis. To be able to assess a larger number of tasks and therefore provide objective data about how we can improve those, to compare new methods before we implement things, grab some data using the old technique, grab it using the new technique, and go from there, make evidence-based decisions and really have a good way of creating effective change, not change for the sake of it, but effective change that reduces exposure to risk.
Now, Chris, you said this is your fourth Retmobile.
That's correct, Carl.
What have you seen as some of the biggest changes over those last 4 years?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And one of the most, I'd have to look at that in regards to two areas. One is equipment and vehicle design. And clearly in vehicle design, the change towards either automated or mechanized or lower demand loading systems and unloading systems for stretchers has been a key change. So there's stretchers with ramps, stretchers with mechanical loading systems. We were looking at a few over the last few days here. That's a major change. The second major change, which is probably not a major change but a slight change, is we've started to see the introduction of some patient handling type of equipment. So just before we came here to this session today, we were wandering past a stand and they had this unusual type of brace that wraps around the upper torso, around this person's shoulders. And so we were having a critical go at that with the supplier, and we were sort of playing with that and trying to understand. And we sort of made some sense out of that. Whether it works or not, we're not really sure. But as I was saying to Andrew and Dan, it's one of the first times I've seen a new product relative to the area that I'm very interested in, and that is, how can we create a better coupling, a better way of grasping people and handling people to reduce those physical demands? So I think we're starting to see those changes, and I think that was a sort of good reflection of that now.
Now that vest, was that for the responder or for the patient?
It's for the responder, so that they can actually, near the back of their neck, create a better grasp, particularly for evacuation, so lateral evacuation from the motor vehicle. It was specific to that task.
Oh, so you put it on the patient.
Yeah, you put it around the patient and grab it. Now, whether I'm not promoting
I wasn't sure if it was a brace for the responder.
No,
the
it's very much... Essentially, from an ergonomics point of view, it's a coupling device, so it's a way of grabbing the patient.
Okay.
Yep, and a lot of the things that we... There's other ways of doing that. You can wrap a sheet around them. You can wrap a strap around them. It's about understanding the biomechanics and saying, how can we sort of reduce forward leaning, forward reaching, bending? How can we sort of reduce those? And because if we can do that, we're very confident we can reduce the biomechanical load. And again, the back motion sensor does that. It's so you can start to validate what, from an ergonomics perspective, seems to be good principles, good basics, but all of a sudden there's the opportunity to measure and evaluate that.
I think one thing we were kind of talking about on the other morning, when you were asking the paramedics, you know, what do you think we should measure? What should we look at? And we talked about stair chairs, we talked about stretchers, and I was kind of bringing up the aspect of, you know, working inside a motor vehicle. You know, you get the driver sitting there, you're kind of twisted in and around to assess them. And it may come that, it may not be a new device or a new object, but it may be more along the lines of educational, operational. That, you know, if this is somewhat of a car wreck, we're taking the roof off. If it's, you know, just one of these minor fender benders, and anything we're trying to see is already, get out. Your feet aren't broken? All right, let's, you know, your neck's okay. Get out and start looking at the concept of a lot less lifting, feeling that we always have to lift. Now, mind you, if the person's having chest pain and they're short of breath, you know, you're going to be lifting some of these folks, unfortunately, because you have to, you know, look at why you're there. You don't want to stress them out anymore. But eventually, it's to the point of, you know, who do we walk, you know, or maybe just have them take a few steps, you know, move the stair chair, and not just, you know, doing these. One thing that just gets me, non-critical situations are the extremity lifts where they come in and they reach behind somebody and grab them. And I've seen more shoulders injured. I've seen, you know, you got an 80-year-old lady just getting the cartilage. You know, it's just. Pop your shoulder right out. But at the same time, to really do that properly, and Chris, please correct me on this one, you know, being ergonomist, is that, you know, I come in behind, I reach around, I grab the opposite wrists, and I give him a bear hug.
Mm-hmm.
I hold him in tight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we, you know, and then my partner grabs under the knees. And that's how we do that lift.
Yeah, so we would call that a fore and aft lift. And usually that would be for a lateral transfer from a seat or a sofa across to a chair or a stretcher, wheelchair or a stretcher. What we would try and do is we would, but there will be a vertical lift component to that and then a lift across. So what we'll try and do is create a pathway on some sort of slide board. We'll then create some coupling around the patient, be that through straps or a sheet, and we'll actually slide or drag or push them across. And so in a sense, we almost try to eliminate the lifting component, which is the high force. You're working against gravity. So we reduce the force and we would then change the direction of force. So it's more forward and front, and the position relative to joints, you're a lot stronger, and also there's lower impact. So we would change, we would rather than say, this is the best way to do this method, we would say, can we change that method? So we're actually reducing those forces and improving those directions of movement.
So, and I think most people, a lot of times, they do it inappropriately because they don't want to touch the patient because you got to get close.
Yeah.
So they're carrying them out in front of them,
yep.
Which we all know, the further out the weight, the more strain.
Absolutely. And again, sometimes these are devices that you can wrap around people helps overcome that concern or that barrier. It was interesting finding that we found with some of our work from 3 or 4 years ago when we were developing a lot of these techniques is that paramedics don't like getting too close to the patient. They might get hit. They might get
bugs.
There's exposures and
bugs.
All sorts of exposures. Yeah.
Bugs.
And so this helps that sort of strategy that we can sort of help them remotely get close.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating seeing what's here at Retmobile, you know, in full Germany with the EMS Safety Foundation and, you know, Dr. Nadine Levick. It's just eyes have opened so much, and I think in some aspect the states are a little behind, or actually I'm going to say are really behind in terms of safety. Of our ourselves and our patients, and we see that here. We were talking to Ronald yesterday about his ambulance, and the one thing I brought up was so how long ago did you guys get rid of the bench seat? And he goes, oh, like 1960s.
Yeah.
I was like, and we still have them. You know, we're just starting to see them disappear.
And Kyle, from my experience, I was at Dallas in October last year, and I was involved in a workshop with the foundation as well as went to the expo there. And you do have precedents entering the market that are demonstrating these types of changes. So as I mentioned earlier, that there is a change underfoot, and there'll be some momentum. Some areas will advance rapidly in terms of their uptake of that, and some will be a bit slower, but that's sort of reflective of the market. But my excitement, and I know it sounds a bit talk show hostive, but the presence of this technology is just phenomenal. And I think you'll find that the opportunities to do all sorts of sophisticated assessments and simple assessments. You know, our capacity to is now approaching that we can start to log physical work demand exposure, where we've got a whole lot of other work exposures to hazards, chemicals, noise. We don't have such tools for physical work demands, and I think this is heading in that direction. And this is really a revolutionary perspective. And I think it's just a matter of continuing to advance that sort of technology and those opportunities. And I think outcomes will prevail, and they will be revealed, and hopefully they're communicated to people in America.
So, if people want to learn more about what you're doing, if people want to learn more about better techniques, what would be some references you would suggest?
That's an interesting call, because a lot of this is, it's again, we're in the ergonomics arena. There's a lot of good work that isn't published. There's a lot of project work that endeavors to establish an evidentiary basis for change, and it's well known internationally within the ergonomics community that there's a lack of those data or reports being published. Part of my goal over the next 12 to 18 months is to start publishing these materials in reputable sort of ergonomics type journals, and in a sense that's a direction that's proceeding. Just can't do it overnight, but it's a missing link at the moment. As Dr. Levick mentioned in our webinar this morning, there are really only two formal papers on ergonomics for in the paramedic, the ambulance industry, and that's in itself is almost shameful. So it's up to people like myself to say, okay, don't just complain about it. You've got to get it out there and do something. And there has been a lot of good work done. There's a massive body of very good work, well-founded, to start publishing that, and also use the opportunity with Proactive Medical to approach organisations and say we can start to quantify this in a much greater basis. Yep. I'll hand over to Andrew for a sec.
Yeah. And so, Kyle, in relation to accessing technology, the technology we've developed, which we call a backstrain monitor, there's a website is probably the easiest way for people to get an understanding of what's going on. That's just www.pro-activemedical, all one word, and .com.
We'll actually put that right on the show notes for everybody, and we'll put a link right to your website so that you can go ahead and click on it, and it'll take you right off to your website.
Yeah, and we'd be more than happy to answer any email or correspondence that people may have.
I know there's a lot of people. I mean, I'm an educator. I've been teaching for 14, 15 years, and try to teach the best techniques and stuff like this. And it's hard because there's not a lot of data out there. You know, we're going by what other people said. It's usually a physician who wrote the book, but he's not an ergonomist.
Correct.
You know, he's not the person who wrote that
Correct.
Section.
Well, one of the testimonies that we had several months ago is we ran a series of training sessions in these techniques for paramedics using these simple items of equipment, and we actually had people who were still in the process of recovering from injury. And they came along to learn those techniques, and for a small number of those, they, on the basis of the uptake of those techniques, were able to return to work, whereas they previously didn't expect to do so. So essentially, it's really good biomechanics pays off, and not only from a prevention point of view, but in terms of a disability management perspective with a population that may have some residual pain or soreness or disability.
Yeah, as a paramedic with a bad back, and I always know when I lift something wrong or do something not right, because I feel it the next morning or I feel it later that day. And that would be an interesting thing to look at in terms of measurement, is someone with a bad back versus someone with a good back, and see, because I'll tell you, I lift differently.
Yeah.
You know, I have to. I mean, it's not, ooh, it's a good technique. It's just, it's different because of pain.
Yeah, and in fact, You're absolutely spot on, and that's where, you know, earlier we were mentioning about building data sets. We actually go from Germany, we go to Denmark next week, and that's exactly one of the studies we're doing over there. So we're kicking off a study over there that's really doing an assessment in controlled, in a controlled environment across a range of different tasks, and then a freelance assessment as well. So each patient goes through a series of controlled activities and then leaves the clinic, and we gather real world data about how they're using their back. What we're getting half of that sample group will be people who don't have any back pain. The other half of the sample will be people who've had significant back pain. So we are really starting to sort of open a bit of a Pandora's box, if you like. I certainly hope this study brings forth a lot of new questions and a lot of answers as well.
Great. And, you know, guys, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, you know, today about it, because it's such an important aspect is, you know, our health. You know, a lot of us want to be in this business for a while, mm-hmm. and, you know, we don't want to just be sitting at a desk because we hurt our back or put out on that. So, you know, on that, Dan, where can people find you if they want to, you know, get a hold of you?
Basically, the website address Andrew mentioned before. So I'll also give you an email address.
Okay.
We can put that up in the notes as well.
Absolutely.
It's the easiest way to do it.
I think also via the EVA Safety Foundation .org website as well. I think Dr. Levick's put a number of links to us. And so I think there's a number of pathways to our door.
Yeah.
And Kyle, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity. It's been great to be able to have a chat about this. We're in an exciting time here, and it's good for you to have the opportunity to share that directly with your peers. I mean, this is fantastic opportunity. I mean, I didn't know this existed, and I think it's a great use of technology, and it's a great use of being able to share information to people in a way that, you know, they can come and go from this. They might take them a couple of hours to listen to this, but I hope they do, and I hope they it raises a lot of questions, and let's ask some questions. Try and answer them.
Well, we're back. That was kind of a painful little situation there. I'm not sure what exactly happened. Let's see. I got 1, 2, 3 guests still sitting here. They are sitting up. There's no smoke coming out off the top of the heads, and they are conscious. They are breathing, so we don't do any CPR. But
Andrew and I, conscious and breathing.
Yeah. Poor Dan.
I'm getting a few in.
Occasionally. I'm not really sure exactly what happened, but that was painful, and luckily the equipment's okay. For that, we do have everything powered up, but I don't know. Anyways, we were just closing out. I'll give you the web address and emails. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on, joining us tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Carl. It was good.
I appreciate it. And finally, Chris, thank you
great.
So much.
No, that was great. Thanks, Carl.
If people want to get a hold of you, Chris, where can they get a hold of you?
I'll have to forward. It's I've got an email address. It's Chris, Chris, dot Fitzgerald, Fitzgerald, at rimformaryservices.com.au.
Excellent. We'll try to get that on too, so make sure I get all cards and stuff like that. So, you know, folks, you have to think about it. You have to think about what you're doing. We cannot just sit here and wait for changes. You've got to be proactive in making your own changes. And there's a lot of simple things that can be done. Mm. Yes, I mean, in terms of new equipment and new designs, it's phenomenal. We've seen stuff here at RepMobile. They're studying these things. But don't wait on those. Start just doing simple changes in your practice. Like we talked about slide sheets and slide boards, and even just using a sheet, the slide from the stair chair over to the stretcher. These are just simple things you can do. Calling for more help. Because, folks, you only have one back, you know, and ambulances at the same time. You know, that's something that's kind of a little bit out of our hand. But, you know, some things you can do as a provider to make things safe is strap your equipment down, make sure it's all secured, sit your butt down, even though here in the States we do have a bench seat, but buckle
pity,
in.
It's pity not, about that, Kyle.
Pardon?
Pity about that.
That's, you know... You know, we hate that thing. We're working on that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're right, Chris. We did see some new ambulances down in Dallas. We saw them in Baltimore when I was there. With the forward-facing seats, and I actually think they're more comfortable, a lot more room, you know, on that. So, folks, you know, take care of yourselves, because that's really the key thing if you want to have any longevity in this business. So, you know, you can find me over at on Twitter at ImageMedic. You can find me over at my website, KyleDavidBates.com. You can also find me over at my other podcast, PDU.com, PEDI-U. .com, and of course here at firstfewmoments.com you can find us. So, folks, just remember, Safety, management, triage, and care are your four core concepts when dealing with anything out there in the EMS field. So thank you and have a good night.